Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The presidential campaign goes back to the future. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. America's founding fathers accused each other of crimes, hypocrisy, and sexual misbehavior, but times had changed until last night in St. Louis. One example, Donald Trump telling Hillary Clinton she'd be in trouble if he were in the White House.
Because you'd be in jail.
Clinton said the real Trump is the one who bragged about being a sexual predator. Each accused the other of lying. As Trump disagreed with his own running mate on using force in Syria, other Republicans are running for cover. We'll hear what's next. Today's talking point, during Yemen's almost forgotten civil war, a U.S. naval vessel comes under fire. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app. Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. In the waters off the Middle East nation of Yemen yesterday, a U.S. destroyer came under fire after Saudi Arabian-led coalition bombers killed more than 100 people during a funeral. On our talking point later, a distant war that can no longer be forgotten. First, as news update, fellow Republicans say that House Speaker Paul Ryan will focus on maintaining the GOP majority in Congress rather than campaigning with Donald Trump or defending his comments. Shane Goldmacher is senior reporter at Politico. Hi, Shane. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on.
Apparently, there was a conference call. All the members of the Republican majority in Congress were invited to attend, and it's from that that this story came.
Yeah, so this morning, Paul Ryan held the first of two important conference calls for House members. And this is when he said he is not going to campaign with Donald Trump. It's important to know that he hasn't yet campaigned with Donald Trump, and he hasn't particularly defended him. But this is a way for him to try to break further from the Republican nominee. And it is, mayhem in Republican circles because there's blowback from Republicans who are unhappy about this distancing. There's blowback from Democrats who are saying you should rescind your endorsement, not just say you're not going to support him publicly. So it's a rock and a hard place for the Republican Party right now.
Over the weekend, when Donald Trump was invited to had been invited to a Paul Ryan event, Ryan then canceled it. Mike Spence, the vice presidential candidate, didn't show up either. And apparently, Paul Ryan himself then was booed loudly by Trump supporters.
Yeah, I mean, all around, the only word you can use for the last 72 hours is really unprecedented. It's unprecedented for Mike Pence, Donald Trump's running mate, to not have been willing to campaign publicly for his partner in running for office. Pence did today come out publicly again and supported Trump. He's done rounds of television interviews, but he stayed silent in the 48 hours after this lewd tape was revealed, and it wasn't until today he spoke publicly on behalf of Trump. Later today, the Republican Party itself, the Republican National Committee, has scheduled a conference call for all of its members. It's not clear what the agenda was. They weren't given an agenda, but one can imagine it's the next steps for the next 29 days.
Now, Trump himself has tweeted at Ryan today saying Paul Ryan should spend more time on balancing the budget, jobs, illegal immigration, and not waste his time in fighting Republican nominee. So he is obviously striking back.
Yeah, I mean, and this is exactly what the Republican Party doesn't want in the final 4 weeks before the election. They don't want Republican infighting, and that's all that they have. The Donald Trump's campaign manager has been on television making accusations of it against Republican members of Congress. The nominee is fighting with the speaker is fighting with the nominee, and almost no one is talking about Hillary Clinton, who made sort of light of all of this last night when, you know, in a brief moment she seemed to lose her cool a little bit and told Donald Trump that his campaign was exploding. And that everything he's doing is simply trying to create distractions and diversions.
Once again, Mike Pence did not attend an event this weekend in place of Donald Trump. There was some thought that he might defect from the ticket or something. Today, he indicated this on CNN.
It's absolutely false to suggest that at any point in time we consider dropping off this ticket. It's the greatest honor of my life.
And there are those, Shane Goldmacher, who are saying that, in fact, I think it was Pence himself, who said that that Trump last night showed humility.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for Republicans, for Pence, for the speaker, here's the challenge. The Republican electorate isn't abandoning Donald Trump in droves. There's a new poll out today from NBC that showed Hillary Clinton ahead 11 points in a four-way race and 14 points in a head-to-head race, and yet more than two-thirds of Republican voters said they're standing behind Trump. So if you're Paul Ryan, you are risking the wrath of the Republican voters who made Trump the nominee. At the same time, you can't just cater to that group because that group is not enough to win a national election. And so this is the pickle that they're in. It's what Mike Pence is in since he signed up on the ticket. It's what the speaker is in, and it's what every single Republican in a battleground state or House district is facing right now. How to distance yourself from Trump, how far to distance yourself from Trump, and whether to distance yourself from Trump.
And the Democrats are trying to take advantage of that in their latest appeal for money. They're saying if we can't respond to these attacks, our huge chance to win in 2016 will be eliminated. So clearly they're now focused on the Congress. We haven't mentioned the Senate.
Yeah, and this is the concern. Look, we're not going to know exactly where the fallout is probably until Wednesday or Thursday. The tape came out on Friday night. It's notoriously hard to pull over the weekend, and everyone knew that the debate was happening on Sunday could change the trajectory of the race again. Today is really the first day that pollsters for battleground races across the country are likely going into the field. They'll be making calls today and tonight and crunching the numbers. As soon as Wednesday, they could release the standing of these various Republicans in key states that overlap heavily with the presidential map, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Florida. These are all states that the Democrats are hoping to win this year.
And the next presidential debate is when?
The next presidential debate is in Las Vegas later this month. I believe it's the 19th, but you have to double-check that date. I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Okay. You don't have to be an encyclopedia, but we're glad to have you on. And just to remind our listeners that there will be another debate between now and the actual election. Shane Goldmacher with Politico. It's always great to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for being back with us today.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll have more on last night's so-called presidential town hall. Was it really a town hall? And we'll talk about the aftermath as well on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. As expected, Donald Trump's comments about groping women, recording some 10 years ago and released on Friday, came up early last night in St. Louis. It was billed as a town hall, but some of the toughest questions came from the moderators. We'll begin with Anderson Cooper of CNN.
You brag that you have sexually assaulted women. Do you understand that? No, I didn't say that at all. I don't think you understood what was said. This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it. I apologize to my family. I apologize to the American people. Certainly, I'm not proud of it. But this is locker room talk.
And here's part of Hillary Clinton's very detailed response.
Yes, this is who Donald Trump is. But it's not only women, and it's not only this video that raises questions about his fitness to be our president, because he has also targeted immigrants, African Americans, Latinos, people with disabilities, POWs, Muslims, and so many others.
Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Always good to have you on our show.
It's always good to be here.
Obviously, Hillary Clinton was ready for that one. She repeated that litany of people that Donald Trump had insulted more than once last night and did it almost the same way every time. How do you think she did in response, and how did Trump come out of this very embarrassing revelation about what he said on videotape so many years ago?
Well, I think she was making the point she needed to make, which is that this is broader than an insult to women, that this is part of his character. I think Trump's goal here was really just to rev up his own supporters. He came out, he may have apologized, but he came out neither remorseful nor chastened, and he immediately pivoted to two points. One, saying, you know, I shouldn't have said this, but I will fight ISIS, which was sort of a non sequitur. And second, saying, you know, what I did was just words. Bill Clinton was, his actions against women were actions. Again, it was the Trump, I think, that his most ardent supporters wanted to see last night, but it left a lot of people in his party sort of aghast. And, you know, going back to your last segment, I think it helped produce what we saw from Paul Ryan today, which is not only an effort to hang on to their majority of the House, but it is also a continuation of this battle that has been going on all election season between Ryan and Trump, which is, as the party comes out of this election, which brand of Republicanism is going to define the party? Will it be Donald Trump's brand, or will it be Paul Ryan's?
Let me introduce Mona Charon. She is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute, conservative, syndicated columnist, political analyst, contributor to the National Review Online. Good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be here, Warren.
What do you say in response to this? Are there now two Republican parties? Is that what we're seeing, a dispute between the people that Donald Trump represents and the people that Paul Ryan represents?
There is a move on the part of some people in the Republican Party to say it's time to dissolve the people and find another, but that is the dilemma that the party finds itself in, is that the very most shrill and hysterical voices of talk radio have created a roughly 40% constituency for Donald Trump that is not big enough to win a national election, but too large for the rest of the party to discount. And so you have this internal civil war, and it is the most severe crack-up of a political party that we have seen in modern history. You have intellectuals at one another's throats. You have leading political figures bouncing around like popcorn in a skillet, not sure exactly which way to go. They endorse Trump one day, then they withdraw their endorsement, then they re-endorse. They're confused. They're trying to follow the winds, and it's a complete mess and a complete meltdown.
Karen Tumulty, back to you with The Washington Post. You mentioned that Donald Trump was prepared and attacked Bill Clinton for his alleged attacks on women, sexual attacks on women. And of course, an hour and a half before the debate, he brought four of those women who claimed that they were, in one case, raped by Bill Clinton forward. They were in the auditorium last night, apparently not in the family box, which is where Trump wanted to put them.
In fact, yeah, the plan on the part of the Trump campaign was essentially to take a presidential debate and turn it into reality TV. And the plan was to have these women walk onto the stage, stick out their hands, and attempt to shake Bill Clinton's hand and then sort of see what he does. What happened is that the chairman of the debate commission, Frank Fahrenkopf, a former chairman of the Republican National Committee, informed the Trump campaign that if there was any effort to make this happen by seating these women in the family box, that they would be escorted out by security.
So, Mona Charon, back to you. Turning it into reality TV, he already did that to a certain extent, didn't he? The way he prowled around, his appearance on the stage, it seems to me, was quite extraordinary. You saw this looming figure behind Hillary Clinton all the time. I think they tried to prevent that by the way they shot it, but it didn't work.
No, the optics were a little peculiar, along with everything else this year. But allow me to say, since I have been vociferously critical of Trump and have been a never-Trumper since he came down his golden escalator, I will say that for Hillary Clinton to attempt to seize the moral high ground is a little bit hypocritical, too, because while she is not responsible for Bill Clinton's behavior, she is responsible for justifying it, defending it, and disparaging the women who came forward, as it turns out, truthfully, in many instances that we know of, to accuse him. And so for her to now somehow take the pose, someone who has lied, who has taken advantage of skirting the law, who has defied subpoenas, legal subpoenas, and so forth, for her to say, they go low, we go high, I think actually the Clintons kind of have a trademark on going low. So she's hardly in a position she's hardly the best critic of Trump's low tactics, low though they are, no question.
When we go low, or they go low, we go high, that, of course, attributed to the First Lady of the United States, she's used it in many speeches. Let me introduce Ed Kilgore. He's a former Democratic strategist, a centrist Democrat during the Clinton administration. He's now a political columnist at the New York Magazine. Good to have you back as well.
Thanks, Warren. Good to be here.
What about this, the idea that Hillary Clinton is a serial liar, that she has no moral claim to higher ground than Donald Trump?
Well, I heard what Mona had to say, and it's a defensible point of view, but I think in the court of public opinion, Hillary Clinton has been adjudged as being a victim of her husband's behavior, whatever you think about how she's justified it. And as a matter of fact, I think the weight of opinion among Republicans has been, this is the last thing we want to bring up. After all, they did impeach the guy. It sort of backfired on them into a notoriously bad midterm election. Why would you bring that up other than to justify yourself, Donald Trump? As far as Hillary Clinton's right to take the high moral ground, she's the only other person in the debating room last night, so of course she was going to exploit it as much as possible. Now, I have to say she gave it rather a light touch. He was definitely, in every respect, the aggressor in this debate.
Did he then do what he needed, as we heard earlier, and did she fail to do what she needed?
Well, I agree with Karen. I think his strategy now is to shore up, and with Mona, his strategy is to shore up that roughly 40%, maybe a little lower, percentage of the electorate that is willing to forgive him just about anything, so long as he carries the conservative movement or some populist version of it line, and he systematically tried to remind his base throughout the debate, not only about the Clinton scandals, but every other kind of hot-button right-wing media meme that we've heard over the last few years. It was sort of the greatest hits. And I think he did probably the smartest thing for him to do tactically, in that situation. But I don't think Hillary Clinton really failed. She did what she needed to do as well. And I frankly, even though I've been pretty skeptical about this idea that we're going to see a huge Clinton landslide now, I do think we're getting to the point where it's pretty clear that Donald Trump is not going to become president. What happens down ballot is another issue.
Well, here's another issue that Trump brought up, another very familiar issue, and one that Hillary Clinton has had trouble with, and that's the email issue for which she was at one point subpoenaed, according to him. Here's more of what he had to say.
After getting the subpoena, you delete 33,000 emails, and then you acid wash them, or bleach them, as you would say, a very expensive process. So we're going to get a special prosecutor, and we're going to look into it, because you know what? People have been, their lives have been destroyed for doing one-fifth of what you've done.
And Hillary Clinton's response with a remarkable interruption.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Yeah. Because you'd be in jail.
Secretary Clinton.
Karen Tumulty, back to you. You'd be in jail. Does that sound, as did the previous comment we heard from Donald Trump, like a threat of a sort that we haven't heard for a long time in a presidential campaign?
Well, it was, in fact, an amplification of his previous declaration that if he were elected president, one of his first acts would be to appoint some kind of independent prosecutor to go after Hillary Clinton, who at that point would be a private citizen. It was extraordinary. It was exactly the kind of thing that became part of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. And it displayed a sort of misunderstanding of what the general view is of where the president's power is and where it shouldn't be. He should not be running prosecutions, and at least not in our system of democracy. So, you know, in that sense, it was a very unconservative statement to say, because it really does suggest a very, very heavy hand of the executive.
Rick Wilson is with us, Republican strategist, who is not rooting for Donald Trump at the moment. Rick Wilson, good to have you on our program.
Thank you so much.
We've heard that there are two Republican parties. Mona Charon seemed to agree with that. That was Karen Tumulty's comment at the outset. Do you agree that as well? And if so, which party do you belong to?
Well, you know, as a guy who's been a Republican political consultant for over 25 years now, I'm having a lot of trouble keeping Republican in my name. And I think that we're about to witness the emergence of a new center-right political party in this country, because the Republican brand has been so, I think, almost inexorably sullied by their embrace of Donald Trump. I think that we've reached a point where the bad faith on the part of the GOP in supporting someone that they knew was a dangerous authoritarian has broken an awful lot of the party in two. I think after this election is over, you're going to see folks who will not repose a lot of trust in either the leadership in the House and Senate or certainly not with the National Party.
Ed Kilgore, back to you. When you were a Democratic strategist, you were involved with the Democratic Leadership Conference. That was a kind of Democratic centralism as well, which, of course, was part of the Bill Clinton presidency. Do you see the same kind of development that we heard predicted by Rick Wilson?
Probably not. I mean, first of all, we were not trying to create a new party. We were trying to make the old party more successful. We never talked about splitting it or running write-in candidates or anything like that. Having said that, there's really been nothing quite like Donald Trump in recent political history. So it's far be it for me to tell Republicans what to do. But I do think the percentage of Republicans that are going to repudiate Donald Trump in November is not going to be that enormous. I think he's going to still wind up with 80 to 85% of self-identified Republicans, which doesn't create the best basis for a new party.
So, Rick Wilson, back to you. What about all those down-ballot races now that Paul Ryan says he's going to focus on rather than the presidency itself? Do you see a chance that what used to be your party, or what you now say is almost your party, could in fact lose its majority in Congress?
Well, I think the congressional majority is still going to be somewhat held aloft by the fact that redistricting has been very kind to us in the last few cycles, and that there's some built-in advantages that we have there in terms of the redistricting effect, the candidate recruitment we've done this year, and the fundraising. However, it is quite obvious that the fact that the Speaker of the House today came out and said, save yourselves, do what you have to do, is a pretty clear sign that he's aware of how deep the rot of Trump has settled into the party with and how dangerous it's become for down-ballot Republicans. So I think we're gonna have a very difficult time holding the Senate at this point. I think the House will be a much closer body than it was previously. And I also think that because of the instability and the erratic behavior of Donald Trump, we could end up with a very late-game surprise that increases Democratic turnout to a degree that we're not anticipating.
Okay.
And that could cause some real changes of the battlefield in the closing days and weeks of the campaign.
Rick Wilson, a Republican strategist. People have predicted that there will be more opposition research, as it's called, against Trump as well. We'll be back in a moment on our talking point later. We'll talk more about Yemen and a new naval ship of the United States being a ship.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the presidential campaign, last night's town hall debate, as it was called, although the moderators seemed to have more of a role than the town hall people did. And, of course, that brings us to the question of language and how politicians use language and how they use various historical references and analogy. Here is Hillary Clinton defending her statement that politicians have both private and public positions. That's something she said in a speech apparently to a Wall Street group that was reported by WikiLeaks and recently released. Here it is.
I was making the point that it is hard sometimes to get the Congress to do what you want to do, and you have to keep working at it. And yes, President Lincoln was trying to convince some people. He used some arguments. Convincing other people, he used other arguments. That was a great display of presidential leadership.
Talking about President Lincoln trying to get the 13th Amendment passed. Jennifer Merchia is an associate professor of communication at Texas A&M. She teaches courses on presidential rhetoric. She's author of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, and she's working on a new book about Trump's demagoguery. Good to have you on our program, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Demagoguery, is that really what we've seen?
Yes. So a demagogue is someone who refuses to be held accountable for his actions or his words or her. And I think that absolutely we have seen Donald Trump use demagoguery throughout this campaign.
What about Hillary Clinton? Trump responded to what we just heard by sneering at the idea that she was using Honest Abe when she, in fact, had lied countless times.
Yeah, that was my favorite laugh line of the debate, to be honest. He said Honest Abe never lied, which is an argument by definition, right? So.
Well, what about the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing on both sides, but particularly what you refer to as the demagoguery of Donald Trump?
Yeah, so there's a few things that I think that he does repeatedly, and he does them very well, in fact, brilliantly, to prevent himself from being held accountable. One, and perhaps most popular in Twitter conversations and whatnot, is that he uses a rhetorical figure called paralipses. Paralipses is the "I'm not saying, I'm just saying" trope. So he'll say something all the time, and he'll say, "Well, I shouldn't say this, or I don't want to say this. I'm actually not saying this, but you know." and then he'll say the thing that he says that he's not saying. Doing that makes it seem like it's a joke. It's a form of irony. And so it allows him to say something without being held accountable, because you can't tell if he's really meaning it, but yet he said the thing that he said he's not going to say.
Well, that's what happened at the end of the last debate when he said, I'm not going to say something about Bill Clinton. But, of course, he went on to say it. But now, forget paralipses. He brought forward the people who claim that Bill Clinton attacked them. Has he abandoned that strategy?
Oh, no. I don't think he'll ever abandon paralipses. I think that bringing those people there was a different kind of strategy. Another thing that he did that we hear him doing a lot is reification. That's treating people as objects and objects as people. So when he talks about women and when he talks about Muslims and immigrants and whatnot, he always uses that instead of who. He talks about it when he speaks about women instead of they or she. And so when you're thinking about the way that he spoke about women on that tape that we all now have heard, it's definitely an objectification of women, treating them as objects.
What about Hillary Clinton's use of Abraham Lincoln, which Donald Trump sneered at, I think effectively?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing. I'm not sure if she did a great job of explaining what her point was. I think that she was trying to make this this historical reference to the public and private distinction that Lincoln had between what he felt personally, thought personally about slavery. He believed in abolition, but he didn't think that it was his job as president. He didn't think that it was constitutional for him to abolish slavery. So there was that very pronounced public-private distinction in his whole, you know, early part of his presidency. It's what Jeremy Bentham calls eulogistic covering. It's using sort of well-accepted or positive terms to reflect policy that maybe wouldn't be as popular if you didn't use it. So, for example, when we pursued the war in terror under the Bush administration, we said that we were fighting to promote and protect democracy. Maybe that wasn't the case, but you can't say, you know, the real reason.
Let me go back to Mona Charon again at the Ethics and Public Policy Institute and the National Review Online. What do you think about what Hillary Clinton said during her speech and the way it was used last night?
Look, and this has been said many times, but almost any other Republican would have been able to handily dispatch Hillary Clinton. She is an incredibly flawed candidate, deeply unpopular, and one of the reasons that she is unpopular is that she has been caught out as unbelievably dishonest, even to the point of possible legal jeopardy on many occasions. And when she was given the opportunity and plenty of time at the debate last night to explain the email lies, that is, she claimed there had been no classified information sent. That was later shown to be untrue. Director Comey confirmed that that was not the case, that she was lying, and so forth. She was eager to change the subject because she has no good answer on that. But it is the great tragedy of 2016 that Republicans, rather than putting up a halfway decent candidate against her this year, chose to commit suicide instead. And so we have what we have.
Professor Merchia, once again back to the rhetoric and use of language. How successful or how inept is Hillary Clinton when it comes to dealing with the email issue? Again and again, Donald Trump said 33,000, you, as he put it, had them acid washed, whatever he meant by that. And she didn't respond directly to that.
No, she didn't. And it might be one of those moments where she said, oh, go to my website, you know, he's lying. She had a hard time, I think, in trying to refute all of the points that he was making and also to try to answer the questions herself. So she kept sort of saying, oh, go to my website, go to my website. We've already talked about this. She did take the moment to say again unequivocally, you know, I made a bad choice. I shouldn't have done that, which is a fine, I think, rhetorical strategy in terms of apologia. But, yeah, these 33,000 emails that he brings up repeatedly sound definitely ominous.
Ed Kilgore, back to you, our Democratic strategist, or former Democratic strategist, now a political columnist at New York Magazine. Do you think she's handling that well, or is it something that's just not going to go away between now and Election Day?
Well, I don't think she handled it brilliantly last night. Again, it matters to some people. It does not matter to a lot of people, including most of the people who are going to vote for her. No, it's not going to go away, but a lot of people just don't care anymore. Now, I would like to address what Mona had to say, because I think we're going to hear an awful lot of this from anti-Trump Republicans between now and Election Day and particularly afterwards. There's nothing wrong with our party, nothing wrong with our ideology, nothing wrong with our agenda. It's just this awful Donald Trump guy who somehow came out of nowhere and took control of our party. And that's possible some of that is true, but I do think we need to remember how poorly Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz in particular were polling against that same Hillary Clinton during the primary season. And there's a reason Donald Trump beat these other people. It was not some sort of satanic conspiracy. It didn't come as a bolt from the blue.
Mona Charon, how do you respond to that?
First of all, Marco Rubio was polling very well against Hillary Clinton, and if primary voters had been strategic, they could have nominated Rubio, and I think romped to victory. But to suggest, you know, that you have, Ed, if you have the magic explanation for why Trump happened in the way that he did, I would love to hear it, because it seems to me that it's a very complex thing, that there are many issues involved, including the different media outlets that people go to now to get their news curated so that they don't have to ever be confronted with ideas that make them uncomfortable on both sides of the aisle. You have the fame of this particular reality TV host. I mean, there, and you have, as I mentioned earlier, some of the shrill talk radio types who have been undermining respect for the institution of the Republican Party for quite a long time, blaming it for the depredations of the Obama administration. But I think it's multifactorial, but if you think there's some simple answer about what led to the rise of Trump, I'd love to hear it.
Well, let me go back to Rick Wilson, our Republican strategist, who's not rooting for Donald Trump at all. In fact, isn't certainly wants to continue to call himself a Republican. What about the fact that there were 17 candidates in the race, and in the first primaries, Trump won by pluralities. He didn't win by majorities until the very end, after he'd wiped away most of them, but not by getting majorities. Once again, only pluralities of the primaries.
Well, it looks like there's about a 32% to 35% demographic inside the Republican Party this year that was very activated, but as my friend Mona says about, you know, certain talk radio and certain news channels, whose hatred of the Republican Party was only slightly less fiery than their hatred of the Democratic Party. And so Donald Trump was able to use those relationships and that free ride he got from Fox, from Rush Limbaugh, from Sean Hannity. I mean, Sean Hannity heads over to the guy's house to shine his shoes every day, it seems like. So, you know, he got a very free ride from those kind of folks, and that activated enough of that plurality to put him where he is. But the problem is that the party is broken itself, because although it's only a plurality, and the remaining, you know, folks that are in Trump's column right now are mostly anti-Hillary, the party has basically taken a poison pill that's going to slowly kill off a lot of its viability, particularly among educated people, among women, among Hispanics, among African Americans. I mean, the fact that my candidate, Evan McMullen, the independent, has very, very little name ID nationally, and is beating Donald Trump 3-1 with African Americans, it should say something. He has poisoned the Republican brand profoundly, and I think that's why I'm talking to a lot of folks about whether or not it's time to reboot and look for a new home for the conservative movement.
We haven't talked about issues at all on this program as yet. One of them, obviously, is the way foreign policy is conducted, and very specifically, what may become the most important foreign policy issue for whoever is elected president, and that is Syria. Here's Hillary Clinton explaining why she supports a no-fly zone in Syria.
But I want to emphasize that what is at stake here is the ambitions and the aggressiveness of Russia. Russia has decided that it's all in Syria, and they've also decided who they want to see become president of the United States, too, and it's not me. I've stood up to Russia. I've taken on Putin and others. And I would do that as president.
Now, during the vice presidential debate, Mike Pence said that he was in favor of using military force in Syria. Once again, as I indicated earlier, the moderators had a lot to do with last night's debate. Here's Martha Raddatz of ABC and Trump's response.
He said provocations by Russia need to be met with American strength, and that if Russia continues to be involved in airstrikes along with the Syrian government forces of Assad, the United States of America should be prepared to use military force to strike the military targets of the Assad regime.
Okay. He and I haven't spoken, and I disagree. I disagree.
You disagree with your running mate.
I think we have to knock out ISIS.
Karen Tumulty, back to you. How important is that going to be, do you think, between now and Election Day?
I think compared to all the other things, were this a normal election season, it would be very important. And it was interesting, too. I went back and listened to what Mike Pence said. Martha Raddatz was absolutely accurate in her description of it. And yet Mike Pence gets on TV today and claims there is no disagreement with his running mate and that Martha somehow got the question wrong. And that is also what happens a lot in this race. Even when Donald Trump and now his running mate are confronted with actual tape of their own words, they deny that they ever spoke them. So it is something that under normal circumstances would be a very big deal. But considering that we are in a political race where everything seems to be written in chalk on a blackboard, I don't know how big it's going to be.
Rick Wilson, back to you, our disaffecting Republican strategist. What about Mike Pence? What do you make from out of his remarks now? He was regarded as having done so well at the vice presidential debate that people were talking about replacing Trump with him.
Well, Mike Pence made no secret of his discomfort with of the fact that Donald Trump was going to take this debate into a very personal area about Bill Clinton's former misbehavior.
Yeah, but today he said, hey, he did a great job last night. He was wonderful. And
right. That's exactly it. But today he flips on a dime. And you know, I've called this in the last year. There's a very Soviet nature to this whole thing. And this. You know, don't be the last guy clapping when Stalin is speaking. You know, this is the kind of thing that Pence has started to display as somebody who has fully bought into the Trump methodology and the Trump loyalty oath game and the fact that Donald Trump demands a sort of level of obedience from people around him and obsequiousness from people around him that we've rarely seen in our politics.
Jennifer Mechia, that's not a question of rhetoric so much as it is of the use of personal power, I suppose. But I'm interested in your response to it and how it impacts what people say at one time or another.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the American electorate has been introduced to a term this election season that maybe wouldn't have entered into political discourse any other year, and that's the term gaslighting. It seems as though what we've heard described by the last two speakers is exactly gaslighting. It's saying that what you think is true is not actually true. What you heard on tape didn't happen. What I said yesterday isn't what I said yesterday. And it makes people distrust what they think, and it also prevents the speaker, of course, from being held accountable.
Karen Tumulty, we're running out of time, but I'm interested to know, do you think that Trump undermined his central argument against Hillary Clinton when they were both asked at the very end, is there anything good you can say about the other? And he said, oh, yeah, she never quits, and went on at some length about that, contrary to what he's been saying about her weakness and lack of stamina.
Right, that low energy, lack of stamina. Hillary Clinton never quits. He will be off of that message within a day, I would predict. Not that I should ever predict anything about Donald Trump. Again, this campaign has these moments, and yet they sort of seem to like disappear the minute the next moment happens.
Okay, that's all the time we have, and I'm sorry for it, but there will be more time as this campaign goes on. Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post, Mona Charon at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and the National Review Online, Ed Kilgore, now political columnist at New York Magazine, Rick Wilson, Republican strategist who's doubtful about that, and Jennifer Mechia, associate professor of communication at Texas A&M. Many thanks to you all. In a moment, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and the almost forgotten war in Yemen. On To the Point from Public Radio International.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Warren Olney here with today's talking point. Why are some bloody conflicts all but ignored here in the United States, while others are continually making the news? This weekend in Sana'a, capital city of Yemen, hundreds of mourners were paying their respects to a family in the death of its patriarch. The funeral was suddenly shattered by aerial bombardment that killed more than 100 people. Shortly thereafter, there was an attempt strike on a U.S. warship off the coast of Yemen. Sama al-Hamdani is a Yemenese researcher and analyst, a fellow at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, if you will, first of all, remind our listeners who have heard very little about what's going on in Yemen, how it is that both Saudi Arabia and the United States are involved.
So it is, in fact, a little bit complicated. It's not as easy as the media portrays. The media usually explains it as a Saudi-Iranian proxy war, but that's just exaggerated. That's not really the case. What's happening on the ground in Yemen can be described as a civil war on one hand, and then airstrikes that are being coming into Yemen in support of an Arab coalition that is headed by Saudi Arabia. The U.S. is supporting this coalition logistically, but it's not just the U.S. It's the U.S., the U.K., and a number of other countries. For example, the U.S. Just recently made a $60 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia, and the U.K., just as of July 2016, made a £3.3 billion deal for arms with Saudi Arabia. So as you can see, they are involved in providing the weapons, and they are also involved by supporting some of the targets or helping Saudi Arabia identify some of the targets that they're trying to wage. The war is mainly between the Arab countries and Yemen's legitimate government that is living abroad currently in the city of Riyadh in Saudi Arabia against what we call the Houthi militia or Ansar Allah militia that is allied with former President Saleh, who was ousted in the 2011 revolution. Unfortunately, he was granted immunity in 2011-2012. He was allowed to stay in Yemen and not be tried for any of his crimes. And this was, again, by the acceptance of the Gulf Cooperation Council. So Saudi Arabia okayed that. But now we see that he is one of the spoilers who is fueling this war.
How is it, do you think, that this war is so little reported here in this country? You said the media often presented in a very simplified way. I think our politicians presented in a very simplified way as well, although they don't talk about it very much. How do you explain the fact that we haven't heard much?
Yeah, well, there are many theories that can kind of explain why that is happening. One thing is that the American audience is not familiar with Yemen, what's going on in Yemen. The only thing they hear from there is about al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula, and still the amount of knowledge there is still very limited. Second of all, the timing of this war is happening when you have a Syrian conflict and a Libyan conflict that is far more important and far more understood here in the U.S. And thirdly, you can explain it, again, due to timing, that it is America pretty much trying to support Saudi Arabian interest while they were also signing a nuclear deal with their opponent, Iran. So it's kind of like pleasing Saudi Arabia, who's been a close ally of the United States for many years. Saudi Arabia is very invested in this war. Like I mentioned before, the Yemeni legitimate government has been residing there for the last year and a half. It's almost 2 years now. The war started in March 2015. And so there are many reasons that it can explain that, but mostly we can talk about U.S. media outlets that tend to cover local news as opposed to international news. And because of that, many of the people just feel like they don't understand what's going on in Yemen or don't really know what's happening there. So Yemen tends to be understood as part of a larger sectarian war that's taken place in the Middle East, but it's a lot more complicated than that.
What has been the reaction in the Middle East itself to U.S. involvement? And is it that reaction that has led the U.S. to at least say it will conduct immediate review of its support for the Saudi-led coalition?
Okay, so there are two things that we need to discuss in terms of that question. First of all, a year ago, there was an attempt to pass a council, an international commission that would investigate human rights violations in Yemen. But it was the UK and the US and Saudi Arabia, of course, that kind of blocked a draft resolution that would pass to the Human Rights Council. And just last month, the EU reintroduced this draft. What they're demanding is an international mechanism of some sort that would monitor the violations that are happening in Yemen in order to hold people accountable. But this hasn't been passed. The Arabs, including Yemen's legitimate government in exile, blocked this effort. But then again, we see today, for example, Zayed ibn al-Hussein, who's the commissioner for human rights in Geneva, he repeatedly keeps on asking for an international mechanism of some sort to report what's happening. On the ground in Yemen, the situation has been really serious and dangerous. First of all, you have the airstrikes coming in, and then you have the Houthi militia that's imposing limitations and constraints on humanitarian work in general. So very little journalists are working actively on the ground, so things are not being reported, and they're not being documented well. This particular incident where they targeted a funeral home was well documented, and there are reports that 140 people died. However, the numbers on the ground are being reported to be around 300. 525 people are reported to be injured. Now, on the ground, all the airports are closed, meaning that those who are seeking treatment cannot leave the country. And hospitals don't have electricity, so those who are on life support won't make it. Airstrikes in Yemen have resulted in about 60% of the deaths in Yemen. So you have the airstrikes coming in, and then you have a civil war on the ground that's happening in several provinces, but the majority of the deaths are carried out by airstrikes. So the reaction in general is that the people on the ground want to hold the U.S. responsible for this, and it seems that lawyers have kind of mentioned that the U.S. could be held accountable somehow for the mistakes that Saudi Arabia is committing on the ground. Of course, Saudi Arabia has not issued an official statement stating that they are responsible for this attack, but that they are in fact sorry for these deaths and that they will go on and investigate what happened there.
In the meantime, you said this was complicated. How about this? The Congress overriding President Obama's veto of a bill that would let the families of victims in the 9/11 attacks sue Saudi Arabia. That seems to have very much disturbed the Saudis. Has that been reported in the Middle East? Are people there aware of it? And what do they think about it?
So, yes, people are aware of it. I think, in general, the people there understand what it could potentially do to the U.S.-Saudi relationship. They also follow the news a lot more closely than some Americans here, in the sense that they know that this could really complicate the oil relationship that the U.S. would have with Saudi Arabia. And they also understand that Congress might try to find a way to reverse it because it seems too good to be true, you know? But on that front, this is a little bit different and separate from what's going on in Yemen, in the sense that that's about 9/11, and what's happening in Yemen is about an active warfare that's taking place right now. I think the most important thing that is not being reported in Congress or in America in general is the degree of the humanitarian crisis that's taking place in Yemen. If you just allow me to present some numbers very quickly.
We are almost out of time, so you have to do it in the next 20 seconds.
Very quickly. Yemen's population is about 26 million people. About 3 million people are internally displaced. They can't leave the country. They're not in their homes. They're living in tents. Some of them are just living somehow. 21 million require some form of humanitarian aid. So that's 21 out of 26 million. And 14.4 million of the people there are food insecure. And 19.3 million people are without access to clean water. A lot of these people are not involved in the war in any way. They're just victims of it. And nobody's paying attention because the war has been extremely politicized, that we're forgetting the amount of civilians caught in this.
Sometimes the numbers speak louder than words. Thank you so much for being on our program, Sama Al-Hamdani, Yemen researcher and analyst at the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies. Great to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.